This week on Decentralize, Augur, Dark Leaks, Open Source Biology, then we talk with David Bailey of BTC Media.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize. So how are you guys doing, and what's new with you?
Oh, this has been a fantastic week. We're getting a lot of things done, on these projects that we're working on. Otherwise, things are good. How about you, James?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to be on the first ever decentralized Google Hangout Live. It's going to be pretty exciting. You can't really see me right now, but I'm sure I'll reveal myself to the viewers at some point. You have a little picture of me down in the corner there. So very excited about that. This is really my main project, and outside of work, and very excited about it.
Awesome. So Tony, you have some news this week. I think last week we kind of talked a little bit about it. You recently joined Augur. Can you tell us a little bit about Augur and what exactly is it that they do?
Absolutely. It was a really interesting project that grabbed my attention, and basically it is an decentralized prediction market. And what it's going to do is give the ability for a prediction market to exist and enable crowdsourcing of decision making to be incentivized. So you will be rewarded for good decisions. There's many ways that people view this, and they've existed in theory for a while. And I actually had the pleasure, since I've been here in San Francisco, to meet Robin Hanson, who's an economist that is very well quoted and is, you know, someone who has spoken on predictive markets for a long time. Academia is very strong on predictive markets, and this is something where the industry has a lot. It's a lot like Bitcoin. It has a lot of legal issues, so there's always ambiguity, and there's issues with many things, but that's where the decentralization part kicks in, where this is how it can change it and make it work in a different way. And Augur's really got a bright team together with some bright advisors, and you know they're in the right place, and they're just kind of putting everything together to make a really successful project. I'm seeing the pieces come together myself. And, you know, the most interesting thing for me is, you know, I'm not a San Francisco guy. For this industry, that's rare because there's, you know, you guys are in Atlanta right now, but, you know, you're also have a heavy presence here. So I got to meet a lot of people in the past few days, especially at the O'Reilly Bitcoin Blockchain Conference that I've spoken with for a year but never met. And every single one of them had questions on Augur. It was a very hot topic of interest because there are people that really are into predictive markets. And when they hear about it, they're very interested. They're skeptical, as they should be, but, you know, they're interested. And it kind of made me realize the demand is there. The execution has to be right. And, you know, I don't want to go into too much detail right now because the project's still very new. And to be honest with you, I'm still kind of learning a lot of the intricacies of prediction markets. I know in general, but there's so many intricacies that you need to learn. But it's a really cool project, and you know, there's people that I've spoken with that will hear about it and say, "Oh, that's Bitcoin's killer app." And I'm like, I can't define that, but I can say it's a really good use of it, and it's something that's really going to give the ability to incentivize good decision making. And that's something, it can work in business, it can work in education, it can work in so many industries, just wherever a decision needs to be made, instead of relying on a manager's opinion or political affiliations, you can, you know, use the wisdom of the crowd to your advantage. And there's no bias because, well, there is going to be bias, but I should say there's limited bias because there's a financial incentive there. And there's also a financial penalty for being wrong. So you have to be sure, or why would you participate? If it's not financial, it can be other kind of rewards, and that's, you know, where the blockchain comes in, where it doesn't have to be money. There can be other cool things. So it's really interesting to see the pieces coming together, and we're going to have people from Augur on the podcast. We're going to talk more about this, believe me, but it's very interesting as a beginning first step into something brand new, really, for this kind of technology.
It's absolutely fascinating, Tony, especially because, it's like you said, it's very much brand new. It's very undefined in the legal sense. But it has so much potential. We discussed back in the Christmas episode, Solr.io, the marketplace for secrets. And one of the things we noted was that generally when you introduce a price system into any kind of market or any kind of situation where people demand goods, you basically have that kind of system for aggregating information and curating the best content. I think it's going to be, you know, not only are you with this Augur platform, creating a platform where people can, you know, use it, not the wisdom of the crowd. It's kind of the idea they mentioned a lot in their material. But they can also use the wisdom of the crowd that, you know, prices represent. with Bitcoin as a currency. So it's very exciting. I think it's going to be a really promising technology, as we mentioned earlier, and we're very excited for you.
Thank you.
So you kind of followed up and talked about the sort of secret sharing thing back in the December episode. Something we haven't talked about is Dark Wallet just today announced something about dark leaks. Did you guys see anything about this?
I did. I didn't research it, but I saw it as a top-rated Reddit post, and it looked interesting.
Yeah, so it looks like it's Peter Todd and the other Dark Wallet guys kind of working on this together. It seems like there's some competition in that space.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. I think, and that's something where I think there's other aspects of that entire leaking culture that have not been explored yet. And it's interesting. It's really it is. And I can't wait to see how the execution comes out. I think that's really what's most important.
It's really funny seeing, like, the inversion, right? So up until now, the people have had, you know, no privacy, right? You know, you've got government spying, you've got nations colluding to spy on their own citizens, and yet now the tables are kind of inverting, where the government keeps all the secrets, right? Right now, and then now there's these markets because of WikiLeaks and some of the tech that's now available. Where, you know, the governments, also known as the corporations or the corporations and governments, whatever, are starting to, like, get cracked open, and they're the ones who are supposed to be, you know, the public servants. Therefore, their information should be shared, and the people themselves are sort of getting the rights to privacy back. And I don't know, I think it's really making a lot of people really unhappy and a lot of people really scared and unsettled, which is something, as you think about, like, this is something like people have to wake up to, right? And I just wonder how long it's really going to take.
It's starting. I think it's starting. I think that's safe to say. You know, it's going to get there. It's just a matter of, you know, enough things happening where, you know, you make that shift and the technology gets easier to use, right? You know, as soon as it's easier to make an encrypted phone call than to buy a black phone and assume the other person on the line is a black phone, that's going to be, and even that has vulnerabilities, because there always will be security vulnerabilities. But, you know, it's going to take a while, and it's going to take a lot of money, and it's going to take a lot of clever people, and, you know, it's starting. It's just, you know, when do we get there? The other, the main problem I would have is naming it, you know, Dark Leaks, Dark Wallet. Like, it does do a good job of naming what it is, but it also brings unwarranted attention. And I think some of these projects would be better served if they were more careful in how they name their products until they get a mass user base.
I disagree. I think if these were products that, like, were trying to be mass marketed, sure. But I think it is very, very important at this very early phase to sort of, you know what, like, radical oppression deserves radical action, right? We need to unify behind something, because our oppressors are here and they're not going to go anywhere until something truly, like, takes place. And you got to get people really behind something. And I think that answer is just, like, it is this sort of feel of a revolutionary, right? Like, this idea of Dark Wallet, it's like, now we have this technology behind us, and we have to really highlight that, right? That, oh, wow, we can actually do true anonymity. Like, Bitcoin is not anonymous.
They proved it in court this week.
Right. Exactly. Like, and that's what a lot of people are saying. Oh, you know, Bitcoin is anonymous. You know, Bitcoin, you know, is for criminals because it's anonymous. No, Bitcoin is, like, the opposite of anonymous. In fact, the only reason it works is because it's a public ledger, right? Mm-hmm. So, but if we can unite behind this idea that, like, yeah, let's get behind this cypherpunk sort of revolutionary anarchist kind of thing, and let's frickin' put it to the man, you know? And I think that's what people really need and really want at this point, or at least there's a subset of people. I think once we get, you know, a few more years down the line, and it's about a lot more than, you know, just us little bundle of guys, like, slowly chipping away at this the block that is, you know, the power block, right, that is in the hands of the corporations and the governments right now. Once it becomes even bigger, then we can start talking about how to market these products and how to genuinely target the mass population who don't know how cryptography works, don't know how Bitcoin works. It's tough because the majority of the population of the United States, the majority of the population of the world, quite frankly, does not care about security or privacy. Right? They don't.
A lot of them don't have a reason to either, though. Remember that. Because, you know, a lot of people just, you know, their communication is day-to-day stuff, and they're like, why would anyone care?
Yeah.
And, you know, you have, but that's not the point. And trying to get people to understand that's not the point. It's a bigger point, and that, you know, there are some things that should be private, and we should try to attain that. You know, it's never going to be perfect. But that, I think, is important. And I think that that user experience is, when people can have as most secure as they can when they communicate, when that happens, for the masses, they're going to have no idea how it works. The same way people don't know how credit card works.
I don't think they need to know how it works, but they need to know why it's important, right? They need to know why it is important for us to have perfect privacy. And I disagree on that. I think that we absolutely can have perfect privacy, and I think the answer is technological in addition to social. I think there's an entire field of study called socio-technical systems, and I think this is, if we can build the technology to make it possible, then the social piece is that sort of unification behind this sort of, like, you know, rebellious attitude, right? And I think that's why that is important, is because you have to plant the seed, right? You have to say, like, let's unify behind this idea that, like, look, you are living in a tax farm. The government, the corporation's, like, job right now is to keep everyone happy, to give you guys content on TV, content on the radio that just keeps you happy, right? Go watch the Kardashians, you know, take a look at, you know, her feminine figure on the front of a magazine, right? Like, just keep people happy, and they'll keep paying their taxes, and they won't question the system. And now the thieves and, you know, the criminals at the top of the ladder will just be able to keep doing whatever it is that they want to do. And once people realize what's happening, then it will matter. Then there will need to be a consumable public solution that isn't branded, you know, dark this or, you know, hack that. Like, it would actually then be within the best interest of the marketing community, of course, to open things up and actually say, like, look, here's Open Bazaar. Here's, you know, this technology that, you know, is safer than everything else that is out there. And it will guarantee you your rights to privacy. And that's where the social aspect of things comes in. You have to have the technical solution first, of course. But the people, you cannot forget that people are a very important component of that. And you have to get people questioning their oppressors, whether or not, because they often don't realize that they're being oppressed, right? It's very indirect. It's very subtle because, you know, the powers that be don't want you to realize that, you know, you're living on a farm that the sole purpose of output of that farm is more taxes and more money, right? They have to pay for the debt somehow, and the reason the income tax exists at all is because of the interest of the money that the government is borrowing from the Federal Reserve, and so on and so on, and very similar systems around the world. So they have to steal from the people to pay off those debts. That's the nature of things, and that is why it's so fundamentally wrong. Next subject, there's a really cool open source biology topic that came up. There's open source plant seeds now. Is this open source genome for, you know, seeds that are, you know, can plant crops? This is really cool.
Yeah, the University of Wisconsin, actually some researchers there have launched the Open Source Seed Initiative. The idea is to really counter the movement in a lot of biotechnology toward patenting certain genetic strains in seeds, because a lot of times when we see with genetically modified plants and even organisms, there is something of a movement. And it's been standard that a lot of these have been patented. This puts a lot of restriction, obviously, on the farmers who use the seeds, on biohackers. So this is very exciting. I mean, we're seeing the idea of open source being brought into a different field than technology, but a field where it's as much as relevant, or, you know, or even more so, because it is dealing with the fundamentals of life. I mean, certainly, like, the whole genetically modified organism debate is an entirely different subject. I think, you know, whether you're for or against it, you can be in favor of these things being open source technologies. You know, you can be a biohacker, you can be an organic farmer, and still like this. Because this is about information being free, no matter which way you cut it.
Yeah, on the GMO thing, I don't think the GMO debate is even a debate, right? Genes modify themselves. Like, GMO is the wrong thing to be talking about here. It's artificial modification of genes that people are concerned about, and therefore I think it is a non-issue. Now, it becomes a non-issue even more so and completely dead in the water when these organizations and corporations are not, it shouldn't be about labeling, right? It should be about open sourcing the genes. Like, what is modified? You know, show me what you modified so that more research outside of the corporation that did the changes should actually be audited. And the same reason that open source software is more secure, open source food would be even safer, right? Because right. Now, like, third parties can actually audit and verify the changes that were made, right? Genetic modification has been around since the first human planted the first seed, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when you plant seeds, you take the seeds from the plants that perform the best, and you plant them again next year, right? And you repeat this, because what's happening is the genes are mutating, and you're taking the best selection, right? You're doing preferential breeding of plants or animals or whatever it may be to select the best thread. Now, the question is, you know, if people are artificially doing this to sort of skip a few generations, you know, like, if you're doing that, you should be required to publish your source code, right? It's the same reason the open hardware movement is very important. You're building hardware. You shouldn't make it proprietary. You should publish the plans, the schematics, everything. In the same way that, you know, I have this personal project where I'm sure you guys have heard of 23andMe and all these human gene testing or mapping companies. I have a project where I want to find a way to get that done, like get my gene mapped, and then publish it with an open license. I have a repository on GitHub where I will be publishing my own genome. But there's a number of people who've also done this. The problem is the licensing, right? If you go to 23andMe, and I wonder if this is the same for this biology thing, is like if you go to these companies and you make these modifications, right, or like you do the testing in the case of 23andMe, they own the rights to your genes, right? If you agree to pay the however money it is, they then own the rights because they ran the tests and they gave it to you at a low cost. You're kind of doing an information property swap, right? And they now own the rights, and they have the inalienable right of, you know, using that in future resource and developments, and you get no part of that, other than the fact that you basically got a discount on your genes being mapped. And I think this is the wrong way to do it, and I will not be doing gene testing until I am able to do so and have the right to openly publish it and completely own the rights to my own genes, or just eliminate rights altogether, which would be ideal. And yeah. I think the licensing question on this biology thing is probably going to be the hot button issue. I think it'll be an interesting subject material for a while, but it's really just going to die, unfortunately, unless someone really gets behind it and works the legal case for it.
And with that being said, I think there is a unique situation with seeds, and I'm not exactly – I don't know enough about it I do know this is a truth, though, and with seeds is a lot of the seeds that are used by the large commercial, you know, corporate – farmers or what, you know, resellers are hybrids, and hybrids do not, you know, they do not have that ability where you can grab a seed and replant it. There's too many issues there. I don't know what the issues are, but it's very much clear if you look into this. So it's almost like nature's patent protection. I don't know, but it's also like no one can ever give me a good reason why you own the rights to that. Like, that's like, to me, is the most insane thing. Like, you own the rights to fucking seeds. Like, that is the issue. And yeah, people are trying to make money on everything else, but it's just ludicrous. And, like, you know, how many hundreds of years were people able to exist self-sustainably on a farm? Yeah, there were droughts. Yeah, there were depressions. There were things like everything else, but you could grow your own food and exist and fine, right? We have all these advancements. So what's ending up happening now is just this weird shift of how farming works and how food reselling works and how food gets to your plate, right? And how many things are involved with it. And some's good, some's bad. But the point of this project, I think, is very awesome, actually. And it really is something that, you know, really is it. There's a lot, like, people love to talk about tech. They think of Apple and they think of Google. They think of cool companies because they use them and tech's cool. These are the companies that are doing interesting shit, like stuff that's actually going to really improve things and projects, companies, whatever, nonprofits, that are actually really going to improve things. And I'm glad some of them fly under the radar, because it's good for everything. You know, sometimes, you know, don't scale too fast. You don't need, this doesn't need to blow up. This needs to, you know, work on the right timeline. And it's very cool. I think this is a very interesting project that I think it makes me want to, like, go through different industries and see how can you take this model and apply it here versus, you know, there's things you can and there's things you can't, and the things that you can, why aren't there more people trying to do it? And I think it's an opening of a mindset, you know, and it's becoming out of Silicon Valley, because it has a mindset of open software is important, because it's what is the backbone of the internet, right? So I think it will continue to grow, and it's going to be awesome.
No, it's definitely very interesting, and coming from a farming background, I do remember seeing oftentimes, you know, we'd buy seed from Monsanto, from all these companies, and there's definitely legal terms attached that limit the freedom of farmers to, you know, innovate and to save their seeds and to try different solutions. One of the big things you identified, Tony, was the fact that, you know, this is not only closed sourcing these sort of projects, these sort of genetic modification projects, but it's also limiting innovation there. So the fact that, you know, this project's moving to actually open source development of seeds, actually fight back against sort of the patent infringement, well, not the patent infringement, but the infringement of the patenters, I guess would be the right way to saying that. It's encouraging. The fewer of these strains and genetic improvements which are being controlled and limited through legal means, the more innovation and the more remixing we can get there. I mean, obviously, I'm sure you all are familiar with the idea of remixing culture or remix culture. Hopefully we see that in agriculture, and I'm very excited about that as a former farmer.
That's awesome. So up next is something that's also really interesting to me. Microsoft really recently launched this really cool tech project, HoloLens. It's a total augmented reality. It's a device, right? And it enables this really cool tech demo that they gave last week, I think it was, for augmented reality. And this is in a very real way that we haven't seen before. Like, we've got the Oculus Rift for virtual reality, you know, where you're literally being moved into, you know, another world that is completely constructed. Where augmented reality is overlaying of virtual objects onto the real world, or more perhaps abstractly, is exposing more information that is not visible to the human eye. So you might consider, like, augmented reality doesn't have to be, like, over your eyes. It's your phone. Metadata that exists at a location, like a point of interest or a Foursquare tip, or, you know, a Yelp review. That is information that exists about the real world, but it's accessible through your phone. That's technically augmented reality, too. What's interesting about HoloLens is that it's full 3D rendering with physics and UI controls and everything on top of the real world. So you could be, you know, in your office or, you know, staying at home and you're thinking about remodeling. You could literally just delete your couch from your vision and see what it looks like. You can add a new, you know, add a new nightstand and see what it looks like in the room while you're walking through the room. And their demo is just amazing. I mean, just go look through their videos. Tony, what do you make of this thing?
The first thing I make of it is it blew away any of Apple's announcements for the past few years. It really did, in my opinion. And that is, to me, something where Apple just announced how much money they made, which is because of smart business practices more than smart technology decisions. And fine, success is success. But you see something like this and you realize Microsoft's still different. The past year has been drastic for them. They finally get it. You know, a lot of companies never get it. I think they got it. And the guy that's in charge now, I think, is doing a great job. And this is the kind of project that we need the largest tech companies to invest in. It may not be successful. Like, Google Glass wasn't a huge success, but it got us a step closer, right? And that's really what we need, what we all need, you know, to happen. So I'm not bullish on it until I try it. I'm, you know, a big proponent of that. And I first tried Oculus Rift. It was an older demo, but last week. And from the hype it received, I was a little underwhelmed. But then I thought about it, and I remember being like 10 and having a Virtual Boy. And I go, this is what was promised then, and it's much closer to what I expected then. And you go, okay, it's going to happen. It's just a timeline, right? Is it going to happen in a year? Is it going to happen in 10? And, you know, it's great. It's fantastic. I can't wait to see how it works. I'm very, I'm not as bullish on the ability to use glasses. Everything seems to be an over-eye. I don't have a better solution, but I don't think that people are going to want that. But you never know. I think if it worked well enough and it was easy and, you know, it didn't make people dizzy, which I understand the HoloLens does not. It's very cognizant of that being an issue with retina tracking and such. More power to them. Microsoft, continue this. Please, please. Like, this is way more important than trying to compete in the mobile phone market. You know, concede that, give up on that, and do something else, and be the first. Right? Yeah.
So there's a couple ways to do it, and I think this is another example of, like, the first step, right? So you've got this over-the-eye thing, and you've got a couple challenges, retina tracking, rectification, how do you know exactly what the intersection of the user's eye and the things that they're looking at are? That's called rectification. There's also projections, right? So you have a couple of fixed projectors that actually paint on top of the real world. And if you really want, like, really good, you know, 3D, multi-user is a challenge here because you have to have multiple perspectives. You might have to have, like, a medium. You're, like, projecting onto smoke or ionized air or something. The other things going the opposite direction, sort of smaller and lighter, are contact lenses, for one.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's a number of experimental prototypes with, you know, at least a few pixels worth of render space that's laid directly on top of the eye. But I really do think that there is going to be, in the future, that there will be two very specific ways of interacting with it. The first will be this over-the-eye display. You will have normal glasses that you just wear. And it has to be small, it has to be lightweight, and it's going to be exactly that. The other thing that I'm perhaps even more excited about is actual implants. Like, I think, at least I'll call this even medium term, is I think that at some point we'll be able to implant devices and you'll just be, you know, you'll be digitally enabled. And then you start thinking about things like, what is that anime? Ghost in the Shell. If you haven't seen Ghost in the Shell, definitely go check it out. And you'll then be able to add apps and plugins and all sorts of things, but it's going to be like an actual implant. So that's like medium term. I place that to be like, you know, 15, 20 years out. Long term, however, is going to be genetic modification and us actually being, like, from birth, being able to grow the ability to see this data. Now, that's super crazy, way far out there, perhaps not even within our lifetime, or maybe it will be if we establish the sort of AI. And this gets me into my transhumanist side a bit. But I do think that actually there won't ever need, by the time we're done with this, we won't need devices to render. And I too am very excited about what Satya Nadella has been doing with Microsoft. I mean, they accepted Bitcoin at the end of last year.
.NET open source.
.NET is now open source, which kind of was an inevitability in my opinion. But God, yeah, they're really, really cranking. I'm really excited to see what they're doing. Microsoft Research, I've always been respectful of. Those guys have consistently pumped out a number of amazing tech. I mean, back when I worked at an augmented reality company that was long before its time. We were trying to do really, really crazy things. I went to an augmented reality conference, and there was Microsoft demoing this really cool thing called Read Write World, I think it was. I think they've since killed the project, but it was like a data layer on top of the real world that you could add data to and interact with, and it was really cool, and it's all coming out of, like, Microsoft Research. So,
hey, more power to them. And with that being said, with the whole different ways to interact and the implants, there is one thing that I'm fearful of, and it's the same thing that would make me fearful of all the missions to space that are being privatized. Right? Is the early adopter curse? Because if you buy a crappy new phone, a new smartphone that's gimmicky, and you want to be an early adopter, and it sucks, you're out money. If you want to be an early adopter and you want to get brain implants because now they finally map neural networks somewhat accurately, you can mess up. That's different. That's health.
Yeah.
That terrifies me. That's the only thing about it that terrifies me, because I think, like, we want to make sure that there's people willing to do this so it improves, but we have to make sure that the risk is there. It's not there. That's
But that's exactly the line. Is, you know, it's courage. right? The people who are really forging this frontier, they don't think, they aren't afraid of it. They stare it down in the face and they attack it head on. The first astronauts, right?
Yeah.
Gagarin, right? Did he express fear? Perhaps. Maybe he was, he was a little bit concerned. He didn't know if he was going to live or die or what have you. But he had the courage to stand up and do it, right? And I think that is exactly what is important. All right, today we have David Bailey of Why Bitcoin Magazine. Thanks for joining us, David. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So talk to us a little bit about why Bitcoin and why it is that you chose to get it all started.
Yeah, so I guess the best place to start is that now officially we're BTC Media. So Why Bitcoin is one media product that we have under the BTC Media family of media assets. So the genesis of Why Bitcoin came from going to the first Bitcoin conference in 2013 in San Jose. And, realizing not just through that trip, but, just at being a Bitcoiner at that time, that anytime you mentioned you were involved in cryptocurrency or Bitcoin, you were asked immediately the same questions over and over again. Oh, what's Bitcoin? And as soon as you answer that, there's a subsequent answer of, oh, why does that have any value? Or, how can that not be hacked? Or, is it secure? Or, how do you even buy it, or can you sell it? So basically very standard questions that logically kind of follow if you're learning about something for the first time. And every single person you told you were involved in Bitcoin asked these same questions. So out of frustration, we printed a magazine that basically summarized the answer to those and concisely and credibly and professionally answered it. So that way, if someone asks you this question, instead of having to engage them in like an hour-long conversation, you can give them like a short 2-minute pitch, hand them a magazine, and say, oh, you can read all about it in this, in Why Bitcoin. So that was kind of the genesis of putting that together. And initially, we weren't sure if it was going to be sustainable or if there was going to be demand for it. And things really took off after, the first issue came out. So we're now on issue number 5. We reached a little over 1 million unique readers last year, or maybe a little bit less than close to 1 million unique readers last year. And we have grown the magazine from the first issue was 52 pages to the last full edition was, I believe, 100 pages. So it's grown pretty substantially. We now have about 100 different companies that advertise with us, which is how we support, the printing of the publication. It's a completely free magazine. And we have about another 200 to 300 companies that either subscribe to the magazine so they can hand it away to customers or, provide us content to include in the magazine or, we have some sort of business relationship with.
Very cool. I'm a fan of it, and I'm a fan of everything you're doing. I really do dig it. The question I have is, what exactly is your goal as far as like your main messaging? And not just that, but your longer-term goal. Maybe for 2016, what are you seeing in the future, the distant future, not just even the near future?
Yeah, so our number one goal is to spread awareness and education about Bitcoin. And, we want to, spreading awareness and adoption means branding Bitcoin in a really positive way. So our goal has been to reach, to try to reach the audiences that and reader that is not going to be the first person necessarily to know about Bitcoin traditionally, or the most cutting edge technology, but is the type of person you need their support for it to really catch on as a mainstream technology. So Why Bitcoin targets C-suite executives, high net worth individuals. Our readership skews a little bit older than your general crowd of Bitcoiners. And we are really trying to provide content to people who are, in their 40s or in their early 50s who are trying to get a grasp and understanding of, why Bitcoin is important and how they can get involved in it. So our short-term goals and our long-term goals are really the same, to brand Bitcoin in a positive way and to, grow Bitcoin from kind of its, garage stage to you know, the first billion users. So, you know, even today, as far as Bitcoin has come, 99.9% of people that will be using Bitcoin on a daily basis have not started using it yet. So it's so early. A good analogy I like to give is, you know, basically we see Why Bitcoin magazines is like our AOL disk, and we're, you know, making as many as we can and handing them out to people so that eventually, you know, they plug in the AOL disk and they plug into the internet. So that's our goal with Why Bitcoin, to kind of keep with that message of high quality content and you know, promoting Bitcoin in a positive way. We actually created a new company called BTC Media, which Why Bitcoin is one subsidiary of. And BTC Media will be acquiring and launching several new brands, all that target a different niche audience and kind of gives the same Why Bitcoin style and quality of content. So our first acquisition that was just recently announced was Bitcoin Magazine, which is, as like an early Bitcoiner, that was a magazine I really had a lot of love and respect for. And I remember the first time I saw Bitcoin Magazine, I couldn't believe that Bitcoin was credible enough to have its own publication. So, you know, we've taken over Bitcoin Magazine. We kind of have it on, I'm not going to say life support at the moment, but, you know, we're basically publishing one article a day on the website. And behind the scenes, we're working really diligently to have a new Bitcoin Magazine website relaunched with a whole new staff of writers and editors, and we're really trying to produce a Bitcoin Magazine that is the number one source of high-quality information in the space, specifically targeting on news. Because with Why Bitcoin, we had people all the time sending us time-sensitive information to publish, and it makes no sense to put time-sensitive content in a print magazine that's going to be in circulation for 5 years. So it just was a natural progression for us to get an online news desk like Bitcoin Magazine, where we can publish this content and have, you know, breaking information. And, you know, we're keeping it pretty close to our chest, the feature set that we're going to be rolling out. But the website is built completely from scratch. It's built on our own technology. It's highly customizable, and we have some really cool things in the works and plan that I think will make, you know, bitcoinmagazine.com the most engaging Bitcoin site out there. You know, one feature I'll leak out real quick that I am really excited about is I'm a huge fan of The Guardian. Whenever there's a breaking news story somewhere happening in the world, where they do a live blog of what's happening, and that's something that we're going to be excited to roll out as well. As you know, if the price is cratering and you really don't know what's going on, you can come to bitcoinmagazine.com and see a live blog with our professional and kind of expert contributors weighing in real time in the live blog, and kind of have someone to hold your hand through the experience.
David, with all these new subsidiaries coming on, can you tell us a little bit about your strategy for bringing on great writers and great content, and your kind of your strategy for producing that and meeting all the different needs of the different markets for Bitcoin, basically? So you have obviously Why Bitcoin, sort of the older audience, maybe Bitcoin Magazine, some of the younger, hipper tech audience. How do you go about finding your authors and finding your content for the most engaging effect?
Yeah, so that's a good question. One of the things we do is we just reach out to Bitcoin experts in the community that you know, we know are going to be a hit. I mean, if you've been in Bitcoin a while, you kind of know the hip names in the space. So for Why Bitcoin, for example, our writers include Eric Voorhees, Andreas Antonopoulos, Tony Gallippi, you know, I mean, crap, we have a ton of them. With Bitcoin Magazine, over the past couple days, we've had stuff come out from Dave Perry, who's Coding My Sleep, which is I'm pretty sure Dave Perry was the first person in the world to get an ASIC miner as a consumer. And so he was real famous for like plugging his butterfly jalapeno back in the day and making like a 100% return in like 6 days, I think is how long it took. And so, yeah, so we basically target people who are well-known in the space, who are popular. We're also targeting mainstream writers who write for, you know, TechCrunch or Fortune or Time that already have a following outside of Bitcoin that can bring some credibility to the table and kind of draw a new audience. And then in terms of, you know, it's a little bit more challenging to find writers who can write technically and write about the more complex parts of Bitcoin and be correct, because honestly, some of that goes over my head, you know, and outside of what I know. So we have a bit of a challenge vetting and ensuring that, you know, our more technical pieces are completely, you know, accurate. And, you know, it's very important to our brand to be seen as credible. So we're doing the best we can to make sure that we don't put anything out there that's, you know, not credible.
As a follow-up to that, and as far as, like, credibility and article sourcing, I know that's an issue other outlets have had. What kind of process do you plan on having for vetting new writers, people that maybe aren't as well-known if you're trying to hire someone, but maybe come from a background with where they really have the knowledge, but you know, maybe they don't have the experience or the credits yet? What exactly would be your process to go through and ask them, you know, why are you doing this? What do you want, you know, what do you want to get out of this? You know, how do you know that they're going to be credible?
Yeah, so basically that. I mean, we would set up an interview. They would have to have some portfolio of work to show us. We'd get our editor to sit down with them and vet them from just a writing perspective. And then, you know, if the content was something that was a little bit over my head, I would track down someone who knows what they're talking about and have them vet it. But honestly, you know, we keep a pretty tight rein and we try to err to the side of caution. So if someone doesn't really have a track record who's trying to break into the scene, you know, starting with us may not be the best place to start building that career immediately.
So talk to us about some of the more exciting things that you think have happened in the past couple months. Obviously, we've had a number of news stories. Take your pick. What would be your top one or two news things that you've covered?
All right. Well, we've only had Bitcoin Magazine for about 5 days, so things that we've covered maybe is not the best answer. If I had to give two announcements or two things that have happened in the past several months that I think are the most exciting, one would be BitPay signing Microsoft to accept Bitcoin, definitely. When I first got into Bitcoin, that happening was considered total lunacy. That would never, ever happen. And, you were just instantly not credible if you tried to say that Microsoft was going to one day accept Bitcoin. The applications that Microsoft could, how they could use Bitcoin are probably what's most interesting, because I think they're going to set the example of how a large corporation can use digital currency to grow their business overseas. And I really look forward to seeing, you know, Microsoft allowing people to, you know, load up and fund their Xbox Live account straight from, you know, South Sudan or something like that. So it's really going to just enable whole new markets for tech companies that really aren't limited to where they can operate beyond, you know, where customers can pay for their service. So I think that's huge. I was at CES just a month ago, and the credibility of Bitcoin amongst tech companies to start accepting it was just at a whole nother level. People follow the leaders, and as soon as Microsoft made this announcement, every other tech company in the space said to themselves, we have to take Bitcoin seriously. You may not end up accepting it, and you may not like it, but you have to at least take it seriously, because the, you know, top three biggest name in tech just did. The other big announcement, which I don't know if you guys will appreciate this one as much, is Coinbase going both, well, really a series of announcements from Coinbase. One, that you're allowed to hold USD in your bank account. USD in your Coinbase account. Two, that you can now use Coinbase internationally. Three, that you can, your money that is stored with Coinbase is insured up to a certain dollar amount. Four, that they are now backed by the New York Stock Exchange. And, five, the exchange is, that's good news, but I mean, there's other high-quality exchanges out there. The reason I think those announcements or those series of announcements are very, very significant is because basically, in my opinion, Coinbase has basically bootstrapped themselves to be a global bank now off of Bitcoin. And this is the first time anyone's ever done that. And they can now offer you banking services, because I can now be 100% in cash at Coinbase. I can now use Coinbase for banking services. You can now use banking services from Coinbase that other banks just can't offer you. Moving money quicker, moving money for free or next to free. And something that's, you know, particularly exciting is if you look at what countries Coinbase operates in, so countries like Greece or Poland or I believe Ukraine is on the list, but there's several countries that, you know, Coinbase has provides their services where the economy or the you know, financial outlook of that place is not very sure. And so now Coinbase can basically allow someone in Greece to be holding U.S. dollars or be holding euros in their Coinbase account, completely segregated from the political risk of their country, and, you know, spend euros just like they would spend euros normally, and have it, you know, transferable to any of their friends instantly, but not have to worry about the political risk of, you know, if the banks fail, and not have to worry about the fees or, you know, charges that come with a lot of these, like, you know, smaller banks in what I would call second world countries. So from that perspective, I think these announcements are huge, because now all of a sudden a standard Greek person can hold euros in an account, have all the different services that a bank would provide at no cost at a fully reserved bank that's insured and backed by the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, that's the first time in history that's ever been possible, ever. And the more and more countries that Coinbase rolls out to, the more and more places that can now say, well, crap, I mean, I could just start operating in U.S. dollars or euros using the Coinbase service and totally bypass my local financial system.
Yeah, when you start to look back and you think about what happened in Cyprus when the price got shot up to almost like $100 and came up from around, you know, $15, $20 all the way up to $100 because, you know, the Cypriot banking crisis. And you wonder, you know, what if these types of systems were in place back then? Like, what if Coinbase had an exchange where you could hold money like that? That would be fantastic. So I guess go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, just I was having this conversation with some of our team here the other day. But the world, like it or not, operates off U.S. dollars right now. And if you travel overseas, U.S. dollars are accepted most places. So, you know, people always say, oh, well, you know, in Greece, they can buy Bitcoin and be insulated from their financial system, which is true. But then they have to, you know, you have to convince someone about the merits of Bitcoin. You at Coinbase, now they can say, hold dollars, which you already hold and already use, or hold euros, which you already hold and already use. And Bitcoin's just a mechanism that allows us to move your money very quickly for free and keep, you know, you know, we can basically hold your euros or your dollars in the United States, and if you want to get paid out, we can pay you out in Bitcoin if for some reason we couldn't give you a cash deposit. So it's really kind of just the next level in terms of this is what how the world already works, and this is what people already expect. You're not having to pitch them on anything new.
Yeah, so as these announcements you kind of talked about, you hit on the things that I'm most excited about. What do you think like 2015 is going to hold? I mean, we're almost a month into it, but you know, how do you think things are going to change this year versus the past few years?
So venture capitalists are not going to get cold on Bitcoin this year. This is going to be a bigger year for Bitcoin than ever. If you look at basically the funding that these venture capital firms are receiving and where it's coming from, venture capitalists who are active in the Bitcoin space are not like the bottom rung venture capitalists. I was looking at some financial results from different VC portfolios this year, and the top two performing VC funds are the Social Capital Fund that's run by Chamath, I can't pronounce his name correctly, and he owns, I think, personally over 100,000 Bitcoins and is insanely bullish on Bitcoin and has been looking for deals everywhere, but is I can quote him in saying that in order to receive a venture capital investment from him, you have to be able to demonstrate your company can outperform the future price of Bitcoin. And he said that's very hard to do. The second company that is really active in the Bitcoin scene right now and the second best performing portfolio out there is Andreessen Horowitz. And they are, you know, making investments left and right. They are even going so far to say that the main focus and priority of their fund going forward for the next couple years will be on blockchain technology. So you basically have the number one and number two best performing venture capital funds in the world saying that the number one thing that they're excited about is Bitcoin. So we're not looking at like the crappy VC firms. We're looking at the best. The crappy VC firms are just going to follow along with whatever the best performing companies or the best performing funds do. So, you know, I think that venture capitalists are really kind of circling the group to determine what companies they can participate in that really have credibility. And, you know, if you look at the credible Bitcoin companies out there and compare it to where we were just 1 year ago, we're talking about, you know, BitPay, who has customers like Microsoft. You're talking about Coinbase, that has over 2 million users worldwide and growing at a faster trajectory than AOL grew. You have BitGo using multi-sig security. You have Circle. You have Zoppo. You have Bitfury, the world's largest miner. You have Bitnet. You have, I mean, there's so many of them, it's like ridiculous to compare today to a year ago and the quality of companies that are out there in the space. So I think you're going to see that continue this year. And from a venture capitalist perspective, once you understand Bitcoin, it's just too hard to say no to. I mean, you're basically making an investment that could, you know, an investment that could become the key part of the global financial system. So it's like seeding Bank of America or something like that, or maybe even more valuable than that. So I think you're going to see more venture capital deals. I think you're going to see more money come into the space. And at a certain point in time from a venture capitalist perspective, like let's say I'm Andreessen Horowitz and I have 15 or 20 different Bitcoin funds or Bitcoin investments, and I'm trying to figure out how to make those investments blow up in value. Well, at a certain point, it's smarter for me to just buy Bitcoin and cause the price of Bitcoin to go up and drive adoption and drive interest. And then all of a sudden, all 20 of my companies that I've invested into have now just blown up in valuation overnight. So if you're really trying to leverage the price of Bitcoin as a venture capitalist, you start by making a whole bunch of investments that are, you know, don't impact the price very much. And then you take $50 million or $100 million and go blow the price of Bitcoin up and cause another bubble. And so I think we see more investments on that front. I think we see continued user growth, which I think is really important because in the past, user growth has almost been completely dependent on the price of Bitcoin. And now because of services like Coinbase, we're going to see organic growth of Bitcoin companies beyond, you know, what's happening with the price. I think we see more and more big name retailers and merchants accepting Bitcoin because literally, you know, companies like BitPay make it where there's absolutely no risk. I mean, the only reason you're not doing it is because at this point is because you're ignorant of why you should be doing it.
In addition to that, you know, it is a little bit skewed with the future in 2015. What's your opinion of all the altcoins? Do you think there's any that have any value? And I don't mean economic value, but I mean as experiments, as features that could be built into Bitcoin, anything like that? Are there any of them that impress you in any way?
There are a handful. Every time a new coin comes out that has something unique about it, I always speculate by buying a handful. So I think 99.9% of what's out there is junk. I think that some projects are extremely ambitious, and you know, I hope they succeed, but I also think there's a lot of unknown variables for some of them. And then there are some that I just think are, you know, I don't know if they have a future or not, but I do think they're innovative. You know, I think proof of stake is innovative. I think, you know, some of these script coins are going to have a very rough time this year, though. I definitely think Ethereum is innovative. I do think it's very ambitious. I think that a lot of the different projects built on top of these coins are very cool, but like, for example, Augur that you're working with, Tony, you know, it's a sick idea. It really is something that has a bright future, but it is relying on, you know, whatever the underlying technology that it's using. So probably the coin that I've gotten most excited about over the past couple days or past week or so from talking to our CTO is just really kind of thinking through the different ramifications of Namecoin and what could be done with that. So, I do think there are some unique alts out there, but for the most part, I spend my time, you know, thinking and focusing on Bitcoin.
So, David, we often hear that the print industry is in decline, but BTC Media and Why Bitcoin are very clearly on the ascendancy. What I'd like to know is how you think blockchain technology and all this decentralized technology is going to impact not necessarily just the print industry, but media in general. Have you thought about this and considered how it's going to impact your work and the work of your colleagues?
Yeah, so just I guess the first thing there is that you're right. Print media is definitely on decline, and it's going to continue to be on decline. You know, we are the media assets that we're acquiring and we'll be announcing, none of them are in print. The only reason why Bitcoin is in print is because basically the marketing strategy that we have for it is a coffee table type approach. We call it push marketing. And to do that, it has to be in print. There's just no other way to do it. So, you know, I 100% agree that, you know, print media is on the decline for a whole host of reasons. Now, how blockchain technology can affect media, that's a good question. I don't really know. There is a lot of speculation about how tipping and micro-tipping will affect media going forward, and we have played with some, you know, ideas internally about how you could do tipping a different way instead of, you know, making tipping something that is suggested. It's something that is automated from a centralized standpoint. But I don't really know. We don't really have many censorship issues in the States. I imagine that, you know, in some of these developing countries, blockchain technology, you know, there's a lot it can do to help with censorship issues. Did I answer the question? I don't know if I did.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. Absolutely. Go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that with censorship issues, you're right, it's a lot less of a big deal here, but it is something that, you know, I think a lot of folks want to be concerned with in general just because of the nature of Bitcoin and, you know, how many things it can rattle, even though I think in the end everyone will be really happy with the results. With that all being said, is there something that people will say to you when you tell them what you do? And do you get a lot of responses that are like, you know, why would you go into that? That doesn't have a future. Because that's still a mindset of a lot of people. And, you know, how do you respond to that in general?
The first thing I say is, well, do you know much about Bitcoin and how it works? And generally speaking, and when I say generally, I would say almost, I would say every time someone says something like that, they have no idea how Bitcoin works. I have yet to meet a credible skeptic of Bitcoin. And I have been to over 40 Bitcoin conferences, both mainstream financial conferences and mainstream tech conferences and Bitcoin conferences. And I have yet to meet a single person who has a credible argument for why digital currency and Bitcoin is not the future. I mean, I've heard all sorts of criticisms of Bitcoin, but I have yet to hear, you know, one reason, you know, why those criticisms are so valid that Bitcoin has no chance of succeeding. So I mean, generally speaking, I guess to directly answer your question, I'll just start walking someone through the potential use cases of it. And once you start kind of opening someone's eyes to it, they very quickly understand the power of it.
Makes sense. I think it's the same thing on our end. I mean, and by our end, I mean everyone in the podcast that discusses this with some other issue. And I think James had a question, so I'm going to let him go ahead.
Yeah. So speaking of all that, with you know, with education, we generally tend to dispel a lot of these objections to Bitcoin. What do you think are the greatest obstacles to educating people? What are the greatest obstacles to increasing this understanding forward? How do you think why Bitcoin's going to address that really?
Yeah, so the biggest issue is just making people care. In the United States, a lot of people just don't care, and they don't really want to take the time to care. The way that you make Bitcoin education important for them is you make Bitcoin do something that they want to do. and then they're going to learn the basic amount in order to be able to do that thing. So the perfect example is a car. No, most people don't care how an engine works, and you're never going to be able to convince them to learn the physics behind how an engine works. But if people want to get somewhere really badly, they will take the time to figure out that you need to turn the key to the car, you need to put gas in the tank, so that you can kind of accomplish what you want. So, you know, I think that the number one kind of barrier to education is having the applications out there that that drive people to want to know more. And then the challenge is to us to have that content ready for them as they come looking for it.
So with that said, is there anything you'd like to plug, any projects that you're working on, any, you know, just anything in general that, you know, you really want to get out there to tell the audience and, you know, a Twitter handle, things like that?
Yeah, so if you're a college student, I highly recommend you get involved in this space right now. There's a lot of companies that are hiring, and there's a lot of opportunity to find your own innovation and start your own company. And I would recommend searching out the College Cryptocurrency Network, which is just a great network of different college campuses that are just looking for people who are interested and willing to learn and open their mind. And then I would also plug Why Bitcoin and Bitcoin Magazine. If you're looking for the latest and greatest in news and information, check out Bitcoin Magazine.
And we will see you next week on Decentralized.